Okay, today I thought I'd give a talk without mentioning jhana. Oh dear, I've already mentioned it. to give a talk today on satipatthana, which is the way to use mindfulness in order to gain deep and penetrating wisdom and understanding. And this satipatthana just actually literally means the place where you focus your mindfulness, developing powerful mindfulness and focusing it in certain areas. And the way the Buddha taught satipatthana, he was saying this, in particular certain areas where it's very useful to focus your attention, your mindfulness, your clear and penetrating awareness, and then you get these amazing results. But really, the wider meaning of satipatthana is like just focusing your attention, your mindfulness, also with a spirit of investigation into any area where there's some sort of problem or some sort of difficulty. Because whenever there's a source of suffering, a source of difficulty, a problem, then if one can focus mindfulness on it, investigation, then one will be doing what we call vipassana, in the sense of one is looking for what the problem truly is. What is the difficulty? What is the blockage? What is the obstacle? To be able to do this, you have to have two things. You have to have sharp mindfulness. In other words, this quality of mind which can look at something and not be fooled by its superficial appearances, but can go deeply into the heart of the matter and find the real problem. And alongside with that mindfulness, again, it really helps to have some knowledge of some of the teachings. So these become the skillful means and the tools, the knife, if you like, which cuts out the tumor of suffering from the heart. And you need to have that sharpness, and you also need to have that little bit of knowledge of decent tools to use. Because once you have tools like the characteristics of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness and non-self, then they become the what you use mindfulness with. Your mindfulness looks, and it carries along with it the tools of mind, of impermanence, unsatisfactory, non-self, to actually see what the core problem is, and thereby can get very deep into the difficulties and problems and then overcome them. However, there's one thing with vipassana, or with insight, is that if it is true insight, if it is really seeing deeply into the core of the problem, it will always give rise to a sense of peace afterwards, a sense of stillness. The problem has been seen. If it truly has been seen, it will be overcome. When the problem is overcome, then there will be peace. And that sense of peace, that experience, is very tangible in the mind. Very often it's accompanied by a sense of happiness and joy that one has seen through a covering over reality, and one has solved a little bit of a problem, and thereby one has released the mind from that problem, and it feels peaceful, it feels joyful. So one of the characteristics of insight when it arises is also gives this sense of peace and joy. Very sometimes the more profound the insight, the more profound that peace, the more profound that joy, which is one of the reasons why and my teacher Ajahn Chah certainly, and many other monks, always used to teach that you cannot separate vipassana from samatha. You have to always be doing both. If you're emphasizing one, the other one will be happening at the same time. And for example, so far this retreat, I've been emphasizing the quietening the mind down, stilling the mind down. I've also been emphasizing that every time you come across an obstacle to that peace, and that's your goal, that's your standard, that's what you use to test yourself, and every time there's an obstacle or difficulty there, to investigate it, to use mindfulness, that penetrating mindfulness which can go to the heart of things, and especially if you can use it with the tool of unsatisfactoriness, impermanence, non-self, to look upon that from that perspective and to see if you can dissolve the difficulty or the problem away. And if you can, you just get deeper into stillness. And as you get deeper into stillness, the ability to be mindful, to be penetrating, increases. And the mind actually gets more power. And that gives it more depth. It's as if it's standing higher and therefore can see further. It sees like a microscope into the heart of things. And this is the mind which has been empowered through samatha. And so it's a much more effective tool to use for vipassana. That's why these two will always go together. And because they always go together, the Buddha gave a very beautiful simile of how the two go together, how you can do satipatthana with the peaceful mind. And that was the simile of the emperor's son. And the emperor had a son, a young boy who was in his early 20s, and decided it was about time to train him to take over the empire. And so one of the regions of the empire, one of the small principalities, quite a way away from the center where the emperor lived, needed a viceroy, either the governor. So he sent his son over there to be the governor, just to test him out, see if he can run a small kingdom as a preparation for running the whole empire. And so he went there to this small kingdom and started ruling it with all the powers of a true king. And just like any young boy in the first time away from home, instead of actually doing his job of running the empire, he actually started partying all the time. He took with him five of his friends, and they just drank, caroused, danced, listened to music all day, all night. And because of that, the affairs of the kingdom started to get into disorder, to the point where some of the important personages of the kingdom, travel back to the capital to complain to the emperor, "Your son isn't doing his job. You know, the law courts aren't being established. The government is being done. No decisions are being made. No work is being done in the city." And emperor immediately understood what was going on, that the son, first time away from home, was partying, enjoying himself, and not realizing that there's an emperor, there's a king, that it's the time to party, and it's the time to do your work, to take your responsibility. So the emperor decided to send his minister, one of his wisest ministers, to his son, to teach him the duties and responsibility of a governor, of a king, and of an emperor. So the minister he chose was perhaps the wisest in the whole of his government. But the minister said, "Please, please, emperor, do not send me by myself, because your son will not listen to me. Please give me one of your fiercest generals from the army to accompany me, and together we will go, and we may be able to teach your son his duties and responsibilities." So the two of them went together, the fierce general and the wise minister. And when they got to the young boy's court, he was right in the middle of a party, enjoying himself. And the wise minister introduced himself, "I'm a minister sent from your father, the emperor." "Get lost," said the son. "I'm enjoying myself." And he said, "Now listen, I'm from your father, the emperor. You may be king or governor of this small principality, but this is under the complete control of the emperor." And his five friends told this wise minister, "You know, you've been told, get lost, get out of here." At which point, the general took out of his sword and started flashing it in front of the noses of his five friends, who immediately fled and disappeared. And then the fierce general went up to the young man, the governor, the king of this realm, and he took him by the throat and said, "I don't care who you are," as he pressed the sword against his neck. "You better listen to this, my friend over here, the minister. or else I'll cut your head off. And this was an experienced soldier in the army who cut many heads off before. And so this young man, even though his father was the emperor, listened very intently. As the wise minister told him the duties and responsibilities of an emperor, of a king, of a governor. And listening intently, the young man realized that you do have to balance things in life. There is a time for enjoyment and there's a time for work. There's a time for doing your duties and responsibilities of a king. That's why you get the perks of being a king and emperor for, if you do your duties. And so the young man learned the duties and responsibilities, and from that time onwards, he always performed his responsibilities and duties in a good and wise way. And when the Buddha told that story, he said that the young man is just like one of my disciples, and I am the emperor. And he said the wise minister is called Mr. Vipassana, and the fierce general is called General Samatha. And they have to go together, because if just Mr. Vipassana, the wise minister, the honorable Vipassana, goes to the court of this young man, you won't listen to him. Insight will not be stronger than your views. So get out of here. And after you said get out of here, the five friends who are called the five hindrances, which surround you and insinuate their wishes on you, these five hindrances will tell Vipassana to go and get lost. We've got no time for you, insight, wisdom. So actually, when the Buddha told his story, he said, one needed the samatha, the strong, fierce general who cut the heads off of many hindrances in the past, to flash the sword, the powerful mind, and the five hindrances, they scatter in all directions, they go and hide, the mind becomes clear, and samatha takes your mind by the throat and says, listen. And then you actually listen to insight, you listen to the nature of things, you see the truth of things. Once samatha is holding you firm, so you can't move, so you have to look, you have to penetrate. I'm going to hold you here as long as it takes, says samatha, until you've got insight. And that's the way that a wisdom arises. That's a beautiful simile, because it's easy to remember, and also brings out the major point of samatha and vipassana. But the subject of this morning's talk is like what Mr. Vipassana teaches you, and where to look. Samatha grabs hold of you and it points you in certain directions. And this is like the focus of your attention, the focus of your awareness. Now the word satipatthana, the focuses of mindfulness, are always used in terms of one particular, or two actually, suttas of the Buddha, which are very powerful teachings, but they should always be kept in the context of their function and also their place in the practice of the meditator. Having told that simile, I should also point out that the very beginning of the Satipatthana Suttas, there's one in the Majjhima Nikaya and one in the Digha Nikaya, there is like a prologue there. The disciple who is doing, say, the awareness or the mindfulness on the body has to be mindful, aware, this is the word sampajanya, putting forth effort, atapi, and the words vinaya loke abhijaga manasang, which are usually very inaccurately translated as having put aside grief and covetousness with regard to the world. And I can't see why good monks should continue with that translation, which actually is quite meaningless. People who look at that teaching just pass over those words because they don't really hit any points in their mind or in their heart which make any sense. Actually, when I started reading the suttas in Pali, it became quite clear, simply because those same words, for example, loke abhijja, and even dhammanasang, are used in other contexts to mean specifically the first and the second of the hindrances. Usually, people always talk about the first hindrance as kamachanda. I haven't actually done the statistics, but in about 40 or 50% of the cases where there's a list of five hindrances, 40 or 50% of the cases, it always begins with loke abhijja or abhijja. That word which is translated as covetousness. And there's at least one place where dhammanasang is referring to the second hindrance of ill will. And even the commentaries to both suttas, the ancient commentaries which were used by the monks to actually explain some of the finer points of these teachings, both commentaries, the commentary to this sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya and the commentary to the sutta in the Digha Nikaya, explain the term vinaya loke abhijja dhammanasang, the term usually translated, which you usually come across as having abandoned grief and covetousness with regard to the world. They explain it very clearly, each time as meaning having abandoned the five hindrances. So what the Satipatthana Sutta is actually saying, and this actually puts it in context, that the meditator does mindfulness on the body, or mindfulness on the feelings, mindfulness on the consciousness, or mindfulness on the objects of consciousness, mindful, aware, with effort, having abandoned the five hindrances. And it's an important statement to make that, an important context to make, because where we're doing the actual Satipatthana of the Buddha, this is a powerful Satipatthana. This is a Satipatthana which doesn't just uncover ordinary obstacles to peace, but which uncovers the root obstacles, which actually leads to enlightenment. And it is why that they have that very powerful quote at the end of the sutta. I just mentioned the beginning. At the end of the sutta, the Buddha says that if a person practices this for 7 days, then they can expect to have some enlightenment experience. Only 7 days. How many days have you got left? Expect an enlightenment experience. That's only if that Satipatthana in that context is done having abandoned the five hindrances, and then you focus your mindfulness, your attention on any of these things, then enlightenment experiences can be expected. So the point of the Satipatthana is, and it's a point which should be made more often, is that the Satipatthana of the Buddha, the Satipatthana which leads to the eradication of that which blocks you from being enlightened, the eradication of illusion within 7 days, is that Satipatthana which is done once the five hindrances are fully overcome, abandoned. Now, you've already been meditating for quite a few days now, and I think that, I'm not quite sure how many of you are now knowledgeable about jhana, but many of you are very knowledgeable now about hindrances. So you know them very well, you've experienced them, and experienced their power. You also experience the difficulty to uproot. So you understand what the problem is, the hindrances. And that's why that it's you need a lot of meditation, a lot of quietness, a lot of eradication of the hindrances. You need this fierce general to flash its sword so the hindrances disappear and disappear for a long time, to be able to do the full Satipatthana of the Buddha. But I will just go back a little bit here. I recognize two types of Satipatthana. The Satipatthana where the hindrances are overcome,
which is the one which leads to the full enlightenment experiences, and also, if you like, an ordinary satipatthana, where you focus your attention on just the obstacles or problems on the way. Both are very valid, both are very useful. And I would not like to denigrate the former while I praise the latter. The former being using whatever mindfulness you have, no matter what strength, to uncover the difficulties and problems, the immediate difficulties and problems in your progress towards deep states of meditation. Because there you're finding out a lot about things like attachments, about cravings, about controlling. You're finding a lot about the manifestation of the self idea. Not as a view, but as actually it comes along and interrupts what you're doing while you're going towards peaceful states. You're going towards peaceful states and something comes up and says, no, don't do it this way, do it my way. That's the self idea coming up. That which comes along and wants to push and pull. That's a craving coming up. You're actually seeing this as it occurs. And as such, if you can develop this first type of satipatthana and notice it as soon as it arises, and use this thing which we call like the full awareness to know exactly what's going on here. Use some of the tools of the Dhamma. Now, is this a manifestation of not seeing impermanence as a problem, or is it a manifestation of control coming from the sense of self? Or is this a sense of craving because it's dukkha and I don't want it? See what the problem is, and sati, and awareness, and a memory of some of the Dhamma should be able to uncover the problem. And you're seeing a very powerful truth, and you're overcoming it, and thereby you're going deeper. That too is satipatthana. Focus your mindfulness, as well as on the meditation object, on the obstacles to that meditation object. Why it's difficult to achieve jhana. Uh-oh, I mentioned it again. Why it's difficult to get peaceful. Why sometimes it's difficult to sit for an hour. Why is it the mind goes into dullness? Why is it the mind starts thinking? This is where one's initial work has to be. Until one, as it were, knows the path, knows the road into meditation so well, one knows all these obstacles. You know them so well that you can avoid them. You can walk around it, you can step over them, instead of always, as it were, like hitting your feet. In the first couple of years I was in Thailand, in Ajahn Chah's monastery, that much of the time we wouldn't wear shoes or sandals, we'd go barefoot. It's probably, I can't remember why, I think it was probably because there wasn't that many sandals or shoes around. So you'd just be barefoot most of the time. And the monastery was in a jungle. The land had been cleared around it over the years, and now it's just surrounded by paddy fields. The only jungle left is actually inside the monastery, inside the monastery walls. But through that jungle, there were paths cut, so you could walk from your hut to the hall, to the toilet, or wherever. But because it was a jungle, and there were so many seeds in the ground, and even like trees underground, you'd always have these shoots coming up through the path. And every now and again, the villagers or the young novices would clean the path up of all these things growing in it. And they'd clean them up with machetes. And they'd cut the roots just below the ground. And so after a couple of weeks, they'd grow up above the ground again. They'd always have these little stumps. And some of them are very sharp, just poking up an inch or two above the ground. And as a young monk, myself and all the other Western monks, the first few months you went there, you're always stubbing your toes on these little stumps in the path, because you were used to wearing shoes all the time. And also because, as a Westerner, my mindfulness was up here somewhere most of the time, thinking. And mindfulness never, very rarely, went so far away from my head to my feet. And that's why I used to have lots of band-aids and pieces of bandage all over your feet, because of the stub and the breaking the skin and piercing the feet. And Ajahn Chah used to see this. These mostly Westerners just having all these bandages and band-aids on their feet. And he said, "You Westerners have got stupid feet." And it was very true that I never thought that feet could be stupid. But it was true, the feet were very stupid, because mindfulness had never accompanied the feet when they were walking. The mindfulness would always be on some sort of high thought about Dhamma, on the unconditioned or whatever else. And it wasn't with what you were actually doing, walking. So it took a couple of months and as much pain and a lot of blood to be able to learn to have smart feet. And it worked. After a few months, you never used to stub your toes anymore. You know, you'd see those roots and you'd avoid them. Even in the dark, when there wasn't much light, you tended to be able to sense them out. Your feet started to become smart, intelligent. And this is what we mean by this mindfulness of the path towards peacefulness. You get to know where all these stumps and these obstacles are. At first, when you walk along that path, you've got stupid meditation. You always tend to bump into the same obstacles again and hurt yourself and have suffering and don't get very far. Sometimes it's the suffering of frustration. Sometimes it's the suffering of tension. Sometimes it's just the suffering of dullness. But these are all like cuts and bruises and stubs which you have on your mind as you try and walk along the path towards stillness. But as long as you develop some mindfulness along with what you're doing and put that mindfulness in the right place, so when you were walking in the forest path in Thailand, the satipatthana, the focus of your mindfulness, was on your feet to protect them. That was the satipatthana, the focus of your mindfulness. In your meditation, the focus of your mindfulness should be these obstacles, so you can always avoid them. And then you'll have a smart meditation, not a stupid meditation. And you will find that your meditation progresses enormously as you move past those obstacles. So that's one part of the satipatthana, one part of vipassana, which I'm pointing out now. Now the other part of satipatthana, the other part of vipassana, which one does when the hindrances are overcome, and you should know by now what the hindrances are, and hopefully you should know by now the state of mind when the hindrances are overcome. And those hindrances are overcome after you emerge from those states which will remain unmentionable, because I made a determination not to speak about them. But they also arise just prior to those states. That's why we have this term, which you've heard before, upachara samadhi, the neighborhood concentration. And that's the state which is both prior and after these states. It's as if when you go into a house, you always have to go over the welcome mat at the entrance to the door. And it's true, to go in the house, you have to step over or wipe your feet on that mat. But also, as you go out the house, you also have to wipe your feet on that mat or pass over it. The upachara samadhi is before and also afterwards. Traditionally, in Buddhism, it's the mat as you exit from the house, the upachara after you've emerged, which is the most useful, because you can stay with the five hindrances overcome for a longer time at that particular point in the meditation practice. Which is why, that's why when the Buddha gained his enlightenment experiences, was after emerging, not beforehand. And after why many monks and nuns gain enlightenment experiences after gaining one of these
absorptions. However, it is still possible beforehand, just beforehand, to also have that upachara samadhi. And the definition of upachara samadhi on neighborhood concentration is just that, when the five hindrances have been fully overcome, when they're absent, when either the general has flashed his sword so strongly that they run away completely, run a mile away, or when they just go outside the door for a few minutes. In either time, the mind has an opportunity to listen to insight and to gain insight. So this is two times. And one of the things you should be developing is the understanding and appreciation of the mind which is free from hindrances. What upachara samadhi feels like, so you can recognize it. So you know the mind which is free from karmachanda or abhijja, which is its concern for the sensory world. Because if you're concerned about trying to make your body comfortable, for example, you cannot truly look at your body with that sense of equanimity, that sense of perspective to fully understand its nature. You have a vested interest in it, so you can't fully see it as it truly is. Or if you have ill will, or if you have sloth and torpor, restlessness, you cannot truly see it as it really is. The mind is sort of agitated. It's like the water being agitated. It bends the light, and what you see isn't a true picture of what's underneath there. Or whether it's when there's doubt, again, it doesn't give you enough time to truly actually see what's happening there, because you're always thinking in the background. You just got to suspend that thought. Suspend what you think might happen, what might not happen, and just look quietly, passively, clearly. So when these five hindrances are overcome at either of these two states, you should know it. Get to know it, understand it, recognize it. Because if the five hindrances are overcome and you recognize it, that is the time to really doing the Satipatthana of the Buddha. That's the time when you should look at either the body, or the Vedana, or I'll explain what these are in a moment, or the Chitta, or the mind objects. You should take that as your object of attention. And the mindfulness, if the five hindrances are overcome, the mindfulness should be strong, stable, persistent, penetrating. Remember that simile, which is actually in the Anguttara Nikaya. I mentioned it in passing, and I talked of the hindrances, using the simile of a glass of water. And the hindrance of sensory concern, sensory desire, is the glass of water with dye and colours in it. So you can't see to the bottom, and you can't see through it. You can see the colours. When it's ill will, it's boiling. Again, a boiling water, you can't see to the bottom of it. The restlessness is when it's waves on the surface, gripped up by the wind, which again means you can't see to the surface. The water has to be still to see to the surface. And the sloth and torpor is when it's covered with moss. It's a lovely sort of simile, that, like moss or algae, which tend to accumulate on stagnant water. And that's like sloth and torpor. If you leave your mind stagnant for too long, don't put forth energy, then sloth and torpor creeps in and covers your mind with algae. Apparently, as in newspapers, the algae is very toxic these days. So be careful of sloth and torpor. You don't know what it might do to you. And that's, again, because it's covered with this moss or algae on the surface. Again, you can't see into it. And the last one, which is doubt, is when it's muddy, murky water. And again, you can't see to the bottom of it. So it's a beautiful simile, because when the glass of water is free from these defects, you can look and see right at the bottom of that water. You can see through it.
You can see its essence, its depth. You understand it completely, thoroughly. It's the same way with the mind. If the mind is free from these hindrances, you can see it thoroughly, deeply, right to its essence. So you take any of these objects of mindfulness, whether it's your body, your vedana, citta, or mind object, and you can see it right to its bottom. You know it thoroughly. And the Buddha is promising, if you know these things thoroughly, you won't be fooled by them anymore. It's only when you can only see the surface, for example, when they're covered with moss, yet you can't see very deeply at all. Or when they're coloured by these beautiful dyes, and so you just get entranced by the colours rather than looking to the depths. Or whether it's like boiling, and you can't see much of it at all, because it's so hot. Or whether it's like whipped up by the wind, which distorts everything. Or whether it's muddy. In each of these cases, you can't see the mind, the muddy mind, the mind which is full of doubt and thinking. You can only see the mud. So, once you have a mind which is free from these things, it should have the characteristic of being very clear. And many people experience a mind which is free from hindrances, just say that, they feel very clear. And they have a sense of like power in the mind, the power to see. And the power to take hold of an object and hold it in front of them and maintain their attention on it, maintain their mindfulness on it, because there's no restlessness there. They can look and look and look and look and never get restless or bored. And this mindfulness, which is free of the hindrances, is the sort of mindfulness which we use in this Satipatthana, the Buddha Satipatthana. And we use it on four areas. Any of the four areas is sufficient, really. Because once you can do it on one of these areas, and you uncover the purpose of Satipatthana in one of these areas, it'd be very easy to uncover it in the other three as well. When you're talking about the body, you're talking about your body, your physical frame here. And the idea in Satipatthana is to use your mindfulness to investigate this bodily frame, to look at it, to penetrate it, and especially the purpose for this penetration is to see nothing else but non-self in its function of not just this is not a soul or an essence of me, but also to the point that this doesn't belong to me, this is not mine. The teaching of non-self has these three aspects to it. Not me, not mine, not a self. And these are three completely different aspects. The not me aspect is the aspect which identifies, in this case, with the body. So, and it gives rise to this quality which we call pride. So we look at my body and I look at someone else's body. I've got a better body than you have. I've got a taller body, I've got a fitter body, or whatever. This is that part of the sense of self which identifies with that as being me. In the sense of judging and comparing, weighing me against you. And that's an important aspect of the sense of self to look at and understand. Because it's that which gives rise to pride, to the sense of ego. It's that actually which causes a lot of bad speech in the world, which is I'm going to put you down and criticize you, and I'm going to point out all your faults and where you've gone wrong, because that way that I am better than you. I feel better than you. It's that sense of me, the sense of I, as compared with you. And that comes, again, from, you can understand what I mean at the source of pride, and you can look at the body as not being me. I cannot use this as a measure of my self-worth, my self-greatness, or anything to do with that. The body is just the body. This is like the me, the mind. I said, well, if you go to the self first, or the third one, not me, not a self. The teaching of self, or the idea of self, is pointing out to an essential, permanent, core reality, which is always there, always will be there. And this is one of the meanings of the term soul or self. The meaning of the word soul or self carries a meaning which has to be something which is always there, a core. If you find something and it's changing, then you look for the core within that, which is unchanging, which is permanent. If you like, the screen on which the images always change. And this is what the meaning of soul or self is. You know, that unchanging, permanent, constant element underlying things. And this is what one is looking for, and one looks for this in terms of the body, or looks to see if there isn't this in the body, to see if there's anything which is permanent, constant, unchanging, running right throughout even your life, from birth until now. And the last is perhaps the most insidious aspect of the self, which is mind. Not that the self abides, or soul abides in the body, but that the soul possesses your body, that the self owns your body, that there's some other self outside of your body, but which controls this body of ours. And that's one of the most insidious, in the sense of the sense of self which we usually fall into with the body. So that's the goal of this Satipatthana of the body, to see not me, not a self, not mine. That's important to keep that goal in mind as you do Satipatthana, because it keeps the focus of mindfulness on track. So it doesn't go off like investigating. The physiological problems of the body and what bones are really like, but it keeps it in track with what in this body can I possibly take to be me, mine, or myself. So you focus on all of your body, parts of your body, and looking at it in a way which can convince you that there's nothing in here at all which you can take to be me, which you can identify with. There's nothing in here which you can take to be a continual permanent self. And also to see there's nothing in here which deserves to be given that characteristic mind. And to do that, we can look at the body in many ways in the Satipatthana. We can look at it just, for example, in its parts. We can take all of the body apart in our mind, the different constituents of this body. And as we mentally take them apart and lay them on the floor and feel that we're just a conglomerate of things, then sooner or later we get the very clear understanding, you know, through the clear mindfulness, that this is nothing essential in this. There's nothing I can identify with this. You know, are you your bowels, or are you your head? As Ajahn Sumedho pointed out in the talk many years ago, he said, when you take a passport photograph, it's always of your head and of no other part of your body. And he was just playing around, saying, if people took passport photographs of their feet, which is just the same as part of you, would you be able to recognize your own passport photograph even? And say, you know, this is me. Well, why not? Because you take the picture of your head and your feet, what's the difference, really? The feet is you. And actually, if you really looked at feet and spent more time watching feet, you probably could see the differences. It's just the same as anywhere else. When I first went to Thailand, all the people looked the same. And it took a while before I got used to the characteristics of Thai people, so you could actually distinguish who was who. It's the same if you've really made a study of feet and really put a lot of mindfulness into feet. You'll soon be able to distinguish my feet from someone else's feet. And it would be true. You would be able to take passport photographs of feet, and the passport officer would look at this and say, look at your feet and say, yeah, that's right, that's you. You can go through. But the point of this whole exercise of feet and heads is the head you? Is it me? And of course, because of our conditioning, we take it to be me. You look at that photograph, and what do you say? That's me. If you say that enough times, you actually believe that it is you. And if that you is ugly, you get very upset. If it's getting very old, you get worried. And it's not you. And it's a great relief to know that your face is as much as you as your feet. It's not at all. Do you worry when your feet get wrinkled? Do you worry about giving your feet a feet lift when they're ugly? Or just your face? Do you worry when your feet get fat and pudgy? Of course not. So again, it's because we identify with these certain parts about being me. And so the meditation, the satipatthana on the body, is just for this purpose. In order to disidentify with this body. And you can understand the results of disidentifying with this body. It gives rise to peace, to tranquility, because you're not so concerned what you look like. You're not so concerned about your personal appearance anymore. Actually, I never really was much concerned about my personal appearance, but now the other monks keep on telling me that, Ajahn Brahm, you're the abbot now, so you should have a shave every now and again. get my hair cut, get it styled. But the more that person identifies with their body, then the more pain, difficulty, worry, suffering they experience. So you at least disidentify with this as being you. And you do this through watching with mindfulness the different parts of the body and realizing whether it's the face or whether it's the feet, whether it's the skin or whether it's anything else, it's not me. And to look at it, the different parts of the body, with the mindfulness on impermanence. And this is where in the Satipatthana we do the death meditations and the cemetery meditations. As in our mind's eye, we just go through the process of decay of this body to the point of death and to beyond. In the time of the Buddha, there would be bodies would be thrown on the charnel ground and just be left to rot or be eaten away by insects, worms or animals. If you want to do the cemetery meditations here, you can just imagine yourself dying, being in a coffin, being sent into the furnace, and then being burnt into ashes. And many of you have seen the ashes of departed ones, and that's all that's left. And so the cemetery meditations for the 20th century Buddhists is just imagining the body in these various states of incineration, the various stages of decomposition according to our hygienic 20th century rules. And what that does, it brings to light very clearly the impermanence of this body, this destiny. And it never gives you a sense of fear. It always gives you a sense of great coolness. That this is where the body's going to end up, and my body is just going to look exactly the same as Arnold Schwarzenegger's after we've been in the furnace. And those of you women here can look exactly the same as Claudia Schiffer after you've been through the furnace. It's going to even us all out. And as such, so you wonder, what is the big problem in the meantime with appearances? The impermanence and the destiny of the body, once we penetrate it with this satipatthana, gives a sense of coolness. it's not me, it's not a self, because it's going to disappear. And also we penetrate it, it's not mine. This body does not belong to me. And the meditations on the body, with mindfulness on the body, especially if it's mindfulness on maybe the painful feelings in the body. And you realize you cannot control these painful feelings. They come according to their own nature. And this recollection, a reflection on the nature of the body, will also help one take away this idea that you control this body of yours. There is a sense that you can influence this body of yours, but you can't control it. It's not really yours. That which we say is mine is that which we can fully control. You might, at a pinch, say you have some sort of joint control with nature. Nature has the upper hand, though, over this body. You can influence it. You can adjust it. But in the end, the true owner of this body is nature. It's like being in a house which you rent rather than you own. If it's a house that you rent, then you have some control over that house while you're the leaser of that house. You can paint it, you can decorate it, you can live in it, you can do what you like in it, it seems. But you know that when the owner of that house tells you to get out because your contract's up, even though you may have lived in that house for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years, you have to leave. You've got no recourse. The owner of our house is nature. And even though we've been renting this house, like someone leasing something, we've been doing what we think we want in this house, then the owner, the true owner of this house we call the body, says, okay, your contract's up, your lease is finished, I want to develop this, I want to put a tunnel through here, then you can't do anything. You have to give it up. You don't own it. And that's a very important reflection on this body. To see it is not mine. We can influence it, but in the final analysis, it is not mine. What's not yours? What's not me? What's not a self? If you truly understand that, you let it go. Why try and fight a battle you can't win? It's best just to be peaceful. And this is what Satipatthana does. It releases your concern over this body, thinking it to be me, thinking it to be mine, thinking it to be a self. You let it go. And you act just like someone who's just renting a house, ready to leave at any moment, knowing your responsibilities, but never for one moment thinking you own this thing. You look after the body, you make use of it, no more. This is what the Satipatthana is for releasing you from your body, from your attachment to the body. This is what we talk about, the meaning of attachment. It's taking it to be me, taking it to be a self, taking it to be mine. Letting go of the body means seeing it's not me at all. Seeing there's not a self in here, this is continually changing. Seeing it's not mine, I just rent this. It should be reasonably easy to do for someone who's got upachara samadhi, who's abandoned the hindrances, to be able to at least do this amount of satipatthana. However, the really juicy satipatthana comes when we start to do the next two focuses of mindfulness. First of all, on vedana. Now what vedana means, there's not an adequate translation in English. Sometimes people call it feeling or sensation. Vedana is that quality of every conscious experience through any sense at all, that quality of every sensory experience which is there in every moment of consciousness, of pleasure, pain, or in between. Even now, you may be listening to this, but at the back of your mind is also, this is delightful, this is offensive, this is pleasurable, this is painful, or somewhere in between. In every moment of conscious experience, one aspect of that experience is pleasure, pain, or in between. In the same way as when you're looking, say, at me, one aspect of what you're looking at is, say, the color. And whatever you look at, there'll always be some color to it. If you look at the air, you can't see it because it has no color. Transparent. But with conscious experience, it always has a quality of pleasure, pain, or somewhere in between. And this is what we look at, this particular aspect of conscious experience, when we're doing the second satipatthana. This is far more subtle than watching your body, and that's why it is much more difficult as a focus of mindfulness. And again, as such, if we look upon this pleasure pain principle, we see very quickly that it's highly impermanent. It changes so quickly. Even that which we take to be pleasurable feeling in the body, or a pleasurable sound, interest, if you like, or a nice taste, or a nice smell, or even pleasure concerned with mental states, we see that it does actually change rapidly. And that which we call like a pleasurable few moments is made up of thousands of spikes of happiness. No more than that. And what pain is? The pain is never continuous. The pain actually throbs. And if you look at just one throb of pain, you see that has got many minor throbs. Peaks and troughs, continually changing. And you see that this is actually the nature of Vedana, which is part of all conscious experience. The nature of that which we take to be pleasant, not that which we take to be repelling, or somewhere in between. When we look at this, again, we should be looking at this in a way which tells us that this is not me. You don't identify with being happy. Look at me, I'm happy. I'm much better than you out there, all just sad and miserable. People actually do that, don't they? They identify, I'm an happy-go-lucky monk. As for him over there, he's a miserable monk. Or he's somewhere in between. That's not the point, because being happy or being sad, the Vedana aspect of it, has got nothing to do with you. It's just nature. It's no more to do with you than the wind outside has got anything to do with you. The wind just comes and goes. One moment it's blowing one way, the next moment it's blowing the other way, twirling around according to the nature of Vedana. We don't take it as me. We don't take it as a self. Jhana. But sometimes one of the difficulties of jhana is it's so pleasurable, we think, at last I've made it. This is the essential me. Because that's what I'd like to be. I'd like to be bliss. Blissed out all the time. Wouldn't you like to be blissed out all the time? Find your essential self, your soul, which is just a mass of bliss. And people can actually make that mistake of thinking pleasant feeling is their essential self. Sometimes people actually, especially negative people, think that this neutral feeling, no feeling, is their essential self. They just like to be completely unfeeling. I don't mean like sort of emotionally insensitive. I mean locking themselves out with drugs or with sleep. They just do not feel anything in this world. That also is not you. It's not a self. So, if we look at Vedana with Satipatthana, we can focus on it to the point where we realize that this isn't a soul, an essence of me, because it's always changing. This is just an aspect, like the color of the apple, no more than that. It's like wind. And also, again, one of the most important features of this, we realize that this quality of pleasure playing with every sensory experience is not mine. You find you cannot control this at all. You cannot just maintain pure pleasure. You cannot even maintain pleasure for a few moments. Can you? If you can, you can just let go completely and there, it's pleasure. You have to continually keep on controlling it, keep on holding it up, keep on aspiring. It seems to be to get pleasure in this world. And there's always things, people frustrating your pleasure, taking it away from you, getting in your way, always things going wrong. It's about time we really saw this through and think, it's not someone out there sort of making it go wrong. Murphy's law, despite its name, is an impersonal law. Murphy does not exist. It's an impersonal law that things will go wrong. And this is the nature of feeling, of Vedana. You see, it's completely out of control. And in fact, if you look at it very deeply, with that sense of dispassion, just seeing it as it truly is, not seeing it as you want it to be, because the desire, the defilements want, we wish to believe, the fantasy is that somehow or other we'll meet the perfect Vedana, the perfect feeling, and live happily ever after. We have the perfect sensory bliss in any of the senses, it doesn't really matter, and then we live happily ever after. But of course, that's just a fantasy. The reality is that Vedana just rise and pass away like everything else. If we can only understand that, we'll get the dispassion towards Vedana. We can't control it. We just have to endure it. And we'll know that truth, which I mentioned before, that pain is just a gap between two pleasurable experiences. Pleasure is just a gap between two painful experiences. This is Vedana. Sensory experience just oscillates between that which we experience as pleasurable and that which we experience as unpleasurable, repulsive, and sometimes it's in between. But we can never get one without the other. In fact, you realize that you measure pleasure by pain. You measure pain by pleasure. That's why people living in concentration camps actually experience pleasure. It's why people living in heavenly realms experience pain. Doesn't matter how pleasurable you make it, when the pleasure just gets a little bit less than it was a few moments ago, that's pain. That's the unpleasant Vedana. So once we see this, that Vedana is not ours, we don't control it anymore. When we don't control it, it's the end of craving for Vedana. We see it as arising, we see it's passing away. We see the danger of it, the mistaking it, the misunderstanding of it, taking it to be mine as something which we'll put a lot of effort into trying to control. In fact, what you do 99.9% of the time in your life is just trying to control Vedana. Get rid of the unpleasant stuff and accumulate as much pleasant stuff as possible. And you'll be working like this till the end of the eon and beyond and not getting anywhere unless you realize that it's a futile task. It's not yours. Drop it. The result for insight into Vedana is the dispassion towards it. that the mind does not worry about and bother about it some more. Instead of being negative towards unpleasant feeling, you realize this is just the way sensory experience is. 1 minute pleasant, 1 minute painful. That's all it is. That's the insight which comes up for understanding Vedana. However, if we go a little bit deeper than this, we see that sometimes sensory experience, and here I go again, ceases. And instead of always having this problem of 1 minute pleasant feeling, 1 minute painful feeling, 1 minute pleasant feeling, 1 minute, after a while you get bored of that. Bit of pleasure, bit of pain, bit of pleasure, bit of pain. And the feeling comes up, I'm getting out of here. And that's when you get out of feeling. You allow Vedana to cease. The full cessation of Vedana. And that's why you might read the some of the Buddha's teachings in the suttas. And he said, a wise person knows the origin of Vedana, knows its danger, knows its taste, its pleasure, but also knows its cessation, where it ceases without remainder. This irritation of the mind, which we call Vedana. This is what we do with Satipatthana. We look very deeply with a mind which is free from hindrances, which can see things which sometimes we don't want to see, which we're not expecting, which we don't like to see. To see things we're not looking for, to put it bluntly. It's very easy to see things you're looking for, but to see things you're not looking for, you have to be sharp. These are these things which you don't want to see. There's also the Satipatthana, which focuses on the citta, on the mind, sometimes called consciousness. I did mention before that consciousness in Buddhism is like six kinds, which is all about the different types of senses, the six different types of senses. However, the citta here is specifically concerned with the mind consciousness, because of all of those six consciousnesses, it's the mind consciousness which is the most interesting and the place where we usually tend to think of me, mine, or a self. Even though sight consciousness, the activity of the sense of sight, is what the Buddha said is consciousness, and the sound consciousness, it's because of the saying afterwards, the mind takes hold of the object of each of the five senses, hijacks it as it were, and takes it for its own. Whatever you see, the mind cognizes next. Whatever you hear, the mind knows. Whatever you taste or smell or feel, the mind knows. And the mind also knows its own objects, which is why that you know that you know. That's just a function of mind. It's nothing profound. That's mind consciousness in operation. Knowing that you know. Knowing that you see. Knowing that you hear. Knowing that you see is the mind knowing a sight object. Knowing that you hear is the mind knowing an object of the sense of ear consciousness. Knowing that you know is the mind knowing its own mind object. That's all it is. I know philosophers and psychologists get really in a tangle over this because they haven't got the separate mind consciousness. They've only got five consciousnesses or five senses usually. Once you understand the six consciousnesses and the function of mind consciousness, how it takes its own object as well as those of the others, you see that it's actually the mind consciousness which is the most interesting type of consciousness to look at. And in fact, it's such a dominant consciousness when people use that term consciousness or vijnana in the time of the Buddha, very often that in the looseness of their speech, that's what they were talking about, the activity of mind. And that's why that when we talk about this word citta, the third of the satipatthanas, that's actually what we're looking at. Mind consciousness.
When we see mind, look at mind consciousness, first of all we have to know what it is before we can look at it, before we can do satipatthana, doing the focus of mindfulness on the mind itself. And again, that's why our meditation, especially attaining those states which I will not name, is very important, because that will be the most powerful experience of pure mind you'll ever have. But if you can know mind consciousness and look at it with mindfulness, clear mindfulness, what you will see is, number one, it's continually changing. And I'm not saying like a chameleon just changing its outer colors. It changes right to the core. So it's one thing arising, then it passes away completely, completely disappears, and another new thing arises. So you see, there's not like a link going through it. A link going through it, the Buddha said, he gave this stimulus like a string of pearls, and the string of pearls is like a string going through each separate pearl. But the nature of consciousness, or mind consciousness, or citta, is it's just pearl after pearl after pearl with no string going through. Because there's no string going through, there is no self, there is no soul. There is no essential reality which is binding each moment of consciousness together in a string, as it were. It's completely different pearls, one after the other. Now this is actually what satipatthana does. It focuses the attention on this, especially to uncover this is not a soul. Also to uncover this is not mine. It does not belong to me. Even your mind consciousness, you have to look at it and see it changes. You try and control it, your mind consciousness. In fact, you've now been spending 4 or 5 days basically trying to control your mind consciousness. How successful have you been? Despite all of your effort, and you put forth immense effort the last few days. You know, some of you might think you've been lazy and you could have put forth more effort. No, no, no. Everyone in this room has put forth immense effort trying to control this mind. Can you do it? You ever thought why? Why you can't do it? The reason is because it's not yours. It's like a rented house. You've got some control over it. While you're inside it, while the landlord is away, you can do what you want, it seems. If you're skillful enough, you know its ways, you can do a lot. But when the landlord comes back, they can kick you out of the house at a moment's notice. Then you realize, hang on, you've got no real control over this. Partial control at most. Even mind consciousness, the jitter, you can see is like that. String of pearls with no string going through it. This is the satipatthana of the mind. And these two, the Vedana and the jitta, are by far the most profound of the two satipatthanas, and you have to be really strong meditator to do those two. Most people just do the body because that's a bit easier. And the last of satipatthana, please excuse me for going on this morning, is the satipatthana, the object of the mental objects, those things which appear in the mind. And those sorts of things which appear in the mind are such things as views, perceptions, thoughts, especially those three. And those are very interesting things to look at with mindfulness. To actually objectively look at this thing we call my view, my understanding, my perception, especially my thought. This is my thought, and it's a really good one. I want to tell you all about it. My thoughts. And with the satipatthana, the mindfulness which is free of hindrances, you can objectively look at these things. The lack of hindrance gives you a perspective, enables you to put it in front of you, a
as they say, with no strings attached, with no vested interest, completely dispassionate, equanimous, clear, just looking at the thought which is arising in your mind now. Straight away, you should be able to see, this isn't me. The very fact that I have a really good thought or a stupid thought, you identify with the good thoughts or the stupid thoughts. In other words, are you clever or are you stupid? Which one are you? You're neither. That's again identifying with thoughts as being me. Are you very perceptive or very dull? That's just thinking you are your perception. Are you a Buddhist or are you a Catholic or are you an atheist or what are you? Is that not identifying with your views? This is me. This is who I am. When you actually can look at these things with perspective, you see, these are just views, that's all. Some of the views are very useful. Some of the views lead out of views. Some of the views just entangle you even further. That is why there is such a thing as right view and wrong view. It's not as if that one view is more perfect than the other, it's just from a pragmatic point of view, a certain set of views lead you out, a certain set of views entangle you even further. That's the only difference. But the point being is that you should be able to see that because the views are impermanent, they're continually changing, despite how hard you hold on to them, eventually you give up, or at least you adapt. And you see that it's not mine, not me, because of their impermanence. You cannot identify a self with these views. It's like things which flip on the screen of the mind and then disappear again, and then come in a slightly different form, moulding with one's experience of nature, of the world. Always being added onto, a little bit subtracted. Always on the move, always growing and decaying, like any other natural force. If you get more information, as you see more things, your views always change. The way you look at it, the way you explain things. They never identify. This is my view, this is me. This is the self. Also mine. When you never take views to be mine, you take them to be you. To just take them to be views, then of course you don't argue about them. Someone comes up with another view. Why does one feel threatened when someone comes up with a completely different view than the one you've got now? It's only because you think, this is my view. I'm not going to allow anyone to destroy it, thank you. It's only when you think they're mine that we attach and hold on to them. So we could just let views just go like the clouds in the sky. One comes and it goes. Another one goes. And they have similar appearances. They're all different views. Different clouds just rolling in the sky of your mind. And it's nice not to have to argue or or debate or worry about people with different views than you. You can allow the whole world to have a completely different view than you have. And you're the only one in the world with right view, and everyone else is stupid. And you don't have to go around convincing the world. Well, you can be the only one, put it the other way around, you can be the only one who's stupid and everyone else has got right view. And you don't have to worry at all. You can be perfectly at peace. Actually, that's right view. So what you can do, once you actually see that the contents of the mind, like you, not me, not mine, not the self. Doesn't it solve so many problems in the world? You don't have to go around convincing anybody else. You don't have to go worrying about trying to make everyone's view the same, which is that terrible thing we call interfaith conferences and ecumenicalism, trying to make everyone the same. Trying to get like just one view. Let's just work it all out, find out the right view, and have everyone with the right view. And then the world will be in harmony, won't it? Or get some sort of overlying view which encompasses everything. And no, that's just like attachment to view again. Just let the whole thing go. We can be completely at peace with different views, even in our own mind, from time to time, let alone within other people's minds. and perception. Sometimes we perceive something and think, this is real, this is true. I've seen this. I've experienced God. I've experienced Nirvana. I've experienced the great white ram in the sky, whatever else believes it. And people say, I've experienced it, this is real. Again, that's just attachment to perceptions again. If we really can use Satipatthana, the focus of clear mindfulness on this thing which we call perception, this activity of mind, this object of mind, we can make it an object of mind, we can just watch perception. And it's a fascinating area to watch perception. Because you see just how unreliable perceptions are. If you go into that kitchen in an hour's time and you're hungry, whatever's put before you, you perceive as delicious. If you've got a stomachache, got diarrhea, no matter, it may be your favourite food, it looks repulsive. It's the same food, the same object, it's a different perception. Your dear husband, your dear wife, sometimes it's the same husband that's never done anything wrong, but sometimes your perception, you can't stand her. Sometimes he's the most wonderful person in the world. Perception. Be very wary of these things. Ajahn Mahapura calls perception the playground of the defilement. This is really where they hold sway and power, because one hasn't truly seen what perceptions are. There's never doubted them. So many people say, I can see this, therefore it must be right. That doesn't follow. Just because you see it clearly in front of you does not mean it's right. It's going to be tight.